playoffs. The coach knew he had no chance with an all-white team. But a forfeit was a loss, and this perplexed him and everybody else in the room. The principal described the burned-out press box, the tension of the past 2 days, the canceled classes, and the phone threats his office had received throughout the day. He was exhausted and jumpy and practically begged the board to cancel. A honcho from the National Guard reluctantly attended the meeting. He thought it was possible to secure the stadium area and play the game without incident, but he shared the chief's concerns about what might happen in the rest of the town for the 3 hours. When pressed, he admitted that the safest route was to cancel. The board members squirmed and fretted and passed notes. While they routinely grappled with budgets and curriculum and discipline and dozens of important issues, they had never been faced with something as momentous as canceling a high school football game. They stood for election every 4 years, and the prospect of alienating the voters weighed heavily. If they voted to cancel and Sloan was forced to forfeit, they would be seen as caving in to the boycotters and troublemakers. If they voted to play and people got hurt in an ugly incident, their opponents would lay blame on them. A compromise was suggested, seized upon, and quickly gained momentum. A flurry of phone calls were made, and the compromise became a reality. The game would not be played that night in Sloan. Rather, it would be played the following day at an undisclosed site in a nearby town. Longview agreed. Their coach knew of the boycott and smelled blood. The location of the neutral site would be kept secret until 2 hours before kickoff. Both teams would drive about an hour, play the game without spectators, and the show would go on. The compromise pleased everyone but the head coach. He gamely gritted his teeth and predicted a win. What else could he do? Throughout the morning and into the afternoon, the train station had been a magnet for reporters. It was the last place Boyette had been seen, and he was in demand. His chilling confession had been on the nonstop cable loop for almost a full day now, but his past had caught up with him. His colorful criminal record was in play, his credibility in serious question. Experts of all stripes were on the air, proffering opinions about his background, his profile, his motives. One windbag flat out called him a liar and went on and on about how these creeps want their 15 minutes of fame and enjoy tormenting the families of victims. A former Texas prosecutor opined as to the fairness of the Drum trial and appeals, and assured those listening that all was well with the system. Boyette was obviously a nut job. As the saga wore on, it lost some of its shock value. Boyette wasn't around anymore to add details or to defend himself. And neither was Robbie Flack. The reporters knew that Flack's car was not at the office. Where was he? Inside the station, Sammy Thomas, Bonnie, and Fanta adopted a siege mentality and tried to work. It was impossible. The phones rang and rang, and every hour or so one of the ruder reporters would almost make it to the front door before being accosted by one of the security guards. With time, the mob began to understand that Boyette wasn't there. And neither was Robbie. Out of boredom, the reporters left and drove around Sloan looking for a fire or a fight. To get to the bottom of things, they interviewed guardsmen as they walked the streets, and they filmed and refilmed the burned-out churches and buildings. They talked to angry young blacks outside of pool halls and honky-tonks, and they stuck microphones into pickup trucks for priceless comments from white vigilantes. Bored again, they returned to the train station and waited on some word from Boyette. Where the hell was he? By late afternoon, a crowd was beginning to assemble in Washington Park. News of this development spread through the media, and off they went. Their presence attracted more young blacks, and soon the rap was booming and fireworks were popping. It was Friday night, payday, beer day, the start of the weekend, time to blow off some steam. The tension was rising. Some 40 hours after leaving the parsonage with an unwanted passenger, Keith returned to it alone. When he turned off the ignition, he sat in the car for a moment to get his bearings. Dana was waiting at the kitchen door with a hug and a kiss and a very pleasant, "You look tired." "I'm fine," he said. Just need a good night's sleep. Where are the boys? The boys were at the table eating ravioli. They jumped at their father as if he'd been gone for a month. Clay, the oldest, was dressed in his soccer uniform, ready for a game. After a long hug, the family sat down and finished dinner. In the bedroom, Keith dressed after a quick shower as Dana sat on the bed and watched him. She was saying, "Not a word from anyone around here. I've talked to Matthew a few times. We're watching the news and spending hours online. Your name has not been mentioned anywhere. 1,000 photos, but no sign of you. The church thinks you were called away on some emergency, so no suspicions there. We might get lucky." "What's the latest from Sloan?"
"Not much. They postponed the football game tonight, and that was reported as urgently as a major plane crash."
"No news from Missouri?"
"Not a word.
It'll blow up soon enough. I can't imagine the shockwaves when they announce they have found the body of Nicole Yarber. The town will explode."
"When will it happen?"
"I don't know. I'm not sure what Robbie's plans are."
"Robbie? You sound like your old friends."
"We are. I met him yesterday, but we have traveled a long way together."
"I'm proud of you, Keith. What you did was crazy, but it was also courageous."
"I don't feel brave. I'm not sure what I feel right now. More shocked than anything else. I think I'm still numb. It was a rather unique adventure, but we failed."
"You tried."
Keith pulled on a sweater, tucked in his shirt tail, and said, "I just hope they catch Boyette. What if he finds another victim?"
"Come on, Keith, he's a dying man."
"But he left his cane behind, Dana. Can you explain that? I've been around the guy for 5 days, seems like a year, and he had trouble walking without the cane. Why would he leave it behind?"
"Maybe he thought he would be easier to spot with a cane."
Keith pulled his belt tight and buckled it. "He was fixated on you, Dana. He mentioned you several times, something like, 'That cute little wife of yours.' I'm not worried about Travis Boyette. He'd be a fool to come back to Topeka. He's done dumber things. Look at all the arrests. We need to go. The game is at 6:30.
"I can't wait. I need something to distract me.
Do we have a bottle of communion wine around here?"
"I think so."
"Good. I need a drink. Let's go watch a little soccer, and we'll spend the rest of the night debriefing. I want to hear everything."
Chapter 33. The meeting was arranged by Judge Elias Henry, and while he did not have the authority to order people around on a Friday night, his powers of persuasion were more than enough. Paul Coffey and Drew Kerber arrived in the judge's chambers promptly at 8 p.m. Joe Radford followed them in, and the three sat together on one side of the judge's work table. Robbie had been there for 30 minutes along with Carlos, and the atmosphere was already toxic. There were no greetings, no handshakes, no pleasantries. A moment later, Mayor Rooney arrived and sat by himself away from the table. Judge Henry, as always in a dark suit, white shirt, and orange tie, began solemnly,
"Everyone is here. Mr. Flack has some information."
Robbie was seated directly across from Kerber, Coffey, and Radford, all three still and subdued as if waiting for a death sentence. Robbie started by saying, "We left Sloan this morning around 5 and drove to Newton County, Missouri. Travis Boyette was with us. The trip took just under 6 hours. With Boyette giving directions, we worked our way through a remote section of the county, along back roads, then dirt trails, then to a place known locally as Roop's Mountain. Secluded, remote, overgrown. Boyette struggled to remember it at times, but eventually led us to the place where he claims he buried Nicole Yarber." Robbie nodded at Carlos, who punched a key on his laptop. At the far end of the room, on a whiteboard, a photo of the overgrown clearing appeared. Robbie continued, "We found the site and began to dig." The next photo was of Aaron Ray and Fred Pryor with shovels. "When Boyette was here in Sloan in the fall of 1998,
He worked for a company called R.S. McGuire and Sons out of Fort Smith. He kept a large metal box, one that was once used for hydraulic tools, in the back of his truck, and he used it to bury her. Next photo, the top of the orange toolbox. The soil was not hard, and within 10, maybe 15 minutes, we found this. Next photo, the top half of the toolbox with R.S. McGuire and Sons stenciled on it. As you can see, the toolbox opened from the top with a latch to the side. The latch was secured by a combination lock, which Boyette claimed he bought at a hardware store in Springdale, Arkansas. Boyette remembered the combination and unlocked it. Next photo. Boyette kneeling at the grave, handling the lock. The color drained from Coffey's face, and Kerber had perspiration on his forehead. When we opened the box, this is what we found. Next photo. The skeleton. Before we opened it, Boyette told us there would be a wad of clothing next to her head. Next photo. The clothing next to the skull. He also told us that rolled up in the clothing we would find Nicole's driver's license and a credit card. He was right. Next photo. A close-up of the MasterCard, also stained but with her name easily readable. Boyette told us he killed her by choking her with her black leather belt with a silver buckle. Next photo. A length of black leather, partially decomposed, but with the silver buckle. I have a complete set of these photos for you boys to take home and look at all night. At this point, we called the sheriff of Newton County and surrendered the site. Next photo. The sheriff and three of his deputies gawking at the skeletal remains. The site was soon crawling with police and investigators, and the decision was made to leave her remains in the box and take it to the satellite crime lab there in Joplin. That's where it is now. I gave the authorities a copy of Nicole's dental x-rays, a copy of the same set you boys inadvertently handed over when you were playing games with Discovery before the trial. I've talked to the crime lab, and the case has priority. They expect to finish the preliminary identification tonight. We are expecting a phone call any moment. They will examine everything in the toolbox and hopefully find evidence for DNA testing. This is a long shot, but DNA is not crucial. It's pretty clear who was buried in that box, and there's no doubt who did the killing. Boyette has a lethal brain tumor. That's one reason he came forward. And he's subject to violent seizures. He collapsed at the site and was taken to a hospital in Joplin. Somehow, he managed to leave the hospital without being detected, and as of now, no one knows where he is. He's considered a suspect, but he was not under arrest when he disappeared. Robbie stared at Coffey and Kerber as he delivered his narrative, but they were unable to maintain eye contact. Coffey was pinching the bridge of his nose while Kerber picked his cuticles. There were three identical black binders in the center of the table, and Robbie gently slid them over, one each for Coffey, Kerber, and Radford. Robbie continued. In these, you each have a complete set of the photos, along with a few other goodies. Boyette's arrest record here in Sloan, which proves he was here at the time of the murder. In fact, you boys actually had him in jail at the same time Dante Drum was locked up. There's also a copy of his extensive criminal record and history of incarcerations. His affidavit is included, but you don't really need to read it. It's a detailed account of the abduction, sexual assaults, murder, and burial. The same story you have no doubt seen a dozen times now on television. There's also an affidavit signed yesterday by Joey Gamble in which he says he lied at the trial. Any questions? Silence. He continued. I have chosen to proceed in this manner out of respect for Nicole's family. I doubt if any of you have the backbone to meet with Reva tonight and tell her the truth, but at least you have that option. It would be a shame for her to hear it secondhand. Someone needs to tell her tonight. Comments? Anything? Silence. The mayor cleared his throat and asked softly, "When will this go public?" "I have asked the authorities in Missouri to sit on it until tomorrow. At 9 in the morning, I'm holding a press conference." God, Robbie, is that really necessary? The mayor blurted.
It's Mr. Flack to you, Mr. Mayor, and yes, it is quite necessary. The truth must be told. It's been buried for 9 years by the police and the prosecutor, so yes, it is time to tell the truth. The lies will finally be exposed after 9 years and the execution of an innocent man. The world will finally know that Dante's confession was bogus, and I'll explain the brutal methods used by Detective Kerber to obtain it. I plan to go into great detail describing the lies used at trial. Joey Gambles and the jailhouse snitch Kerber and Coffey rounded up and cut a deal with. And I'll describe all the dirty tactics used at trial. I'll probably have the opportunity to remind everyone that Mr. Coffey was sleeping with the judge during the trial, just in case anyone has forgotten. I wish the Bloodhound was still alive. What was his name?
Yogi, Carlos said.
How could I forget? I wish old Yogi were still alive so I could show him to the world and call him a stupid son of a bitch again. I figure it might be a long press conference. You boys are invited.
Questions? Comments?
Paul Coffey's mouth opened slightly as if words were being formed, but words failed him.
Robbie was far from finished.
And just so you boys will know what's coming in the next few days, I'll file at least 2 lawsuits Monday morning, one here in state court naming you as defendants along with the city, county, and half the state. Another one will be filed in federal court, a civil rights action with a long list of allegations. You'll be named in that one also. I might file another one or two if I can find a cause of action. I plan to contact the Justice Department and request an investigation. For you, Coffey, I plan to file a complaint with the State Bar Association for ethics violations. Not that I expect the State Bar to show much of an interest, but you will get chewed up in the process. You might want to start thinking about a resignation. For you, Kerber, early retirement is now a real option. You should be fired, but I doubt the mayor and the city council have the balls to do that. Chief, you were the assistant chief when this investigation got off track. You will be named as a defendant too, but don't take it personally. I'm suing everybody. The chief slowly stood up and walked toward the door.
You're leaving, Mr. Radford? The judge asked, in a tone that left no doubt such an abrupt exit would be frowned upon.
My job does not require me to sit and listen to pompous assholes like Robbie Flack, the chief replied.
The meeting is not over,
Judge Henry said sternly.
I'd stay if I were you, the mayor said, and the chief decided to stay.
He assumed a position by the door. Robbie stared at Kerber and Coffey, then said,
So, last night you had a little party by the lake to celebrate. Now I guess the party is over.
We always thought Drum had an accomplice,
Coffey managed to blurt out, though his words trailed off under the weight of their own absurdity. Kerber nodded quickly, ready to pounce on any new theory that might save them.
Good God, Paul, Judge Henry roared in disbelief.
Robbie was laughing. The mayor's jaw had dropped in shock.
Great, Robbie yelled. Wonderful. Brilliant. Suddenly a new theory, one that has never been mentioned before. One with absolutely no relation to the truth. Let the lying begin.
We have a website, Coffee, and my sidekick Carlos here is going to keep a tally of the lies. Lies from the two of you, from the governor, the courts, maybe even dear Judge Vivian Grail, if we can find her. You have lied for 9 years in order to kill an innocent man, and now that we know the truth, now that your lies will be exposed, you insist on doing precisely what you have always done. Lie. You make me want to puke, Coffey.
Judge, can we leave now? Coffey asked.
Just a moment.
A cell phone rang and Carlos grabbed it.
It's the crime lab, Robbie.
Robbie reached over, took the phone. The conversation was brief, and there were no surprises. When it ended, Robbie said,
Positive ID.
It's Nicole. The room was quiet as they thought about the girl. Judge Henry eventually said,
I am concerned about her family, gentlemen. How do we break the news?
Drew Kerber was perspiring and appeared to be on the brink of an attack of some variety. He was not thinking about Nicole's family. He had a wife, a house full of kids, lots of debts, and a reputation. Paul Coffey could not even begin to imagine a conversation with Riva about this little twist to their story. No, he would not do it. He would rather run like a coward than deal with that woman. Admitting they had prosecuted and executed the wrong man was, at the moment, far beyond the limits of his imagination. There were no volunteers. Robbie said, "Obviously, Judge, I'm not the guy. I have my own little trip to make over to the drum home to deliver the news."
"Mr. Kerber?" the judge asked.
He shook his head no.
"Mr. Coffey?"
He shook his head no.
"Very well. I will call her mother myself and break the news."
"How late can you wait, Judge?" the mayor asked. "If this hits the streets tonight, then God help us."
"Who is in the loop, Robbie?" the judge asked.
"My office, the seven of us in this room, the authorities in Missouri. We also took a TV crew with us, but they won't air anything until I say so. It's a small world right now."
"I'll wait 2 hours," Judge Henry said. "This meeting is adjourned."
Roberta Drum was at home with Andrea and a few friends. The kitchen table and counters were covered with food. Casseroles, platters of fried chicken, cakes and pies, enough food to feed 100. Robbie had forgotten to eat dinner, so he snacked as he and Martha waited for the friends to leave. Roberta was thoroughly drained. After a day receiving guests at the funeral home and crying with most of them, she was emotionally and physically spent. And so Robbie made things much worse by delivering the news. He had no choice. He began with the journey to Missouri and finished with the meeting in Judge Henry's office. He and Martha helped Andrea put Roberta in bed. She was conscious, but barely. Knowing that Dante was about to be exonerated, and before he was buried, was simply too much. The sirens were quiet until 10 minutes after 11 p.m. Three quick 911 calls got them started. The first reported a fire in a shopping center north of town. Evidently, someone tossed a Molotov cocktail through the front window of a clothing store, and a passing motorist saw flames. The second call, anonymous, reported a burning school bus parked behind the junior high. And the third, and most ominous, was from a fire alarm system at a feed store. Its owner was Wallace Pike, Reva's husband. The police and guardsmen, already on high alert, stepped up their patrols and surveillance, and for the third straight night, Sloan endured the sirens and the smoke. Long after the boys were asleep, Keith and Dana sat in the dark den and sipped wine from coffee cups. As Keith told his story, the details poured out, and he remembered facts and sounds and smells for the first time. The little thing surprised him. The sound of Boyette heaving in the grass beside the interstate. The lethargy of the state trooper as he went about the task of writing the speeding ticket. The stacks of paperwork on the long table in Robbie's conference room. The looks of fear on the faces of his staff. The antiseptic smell of the holding room in the death house. The ringing in Keith's ears as he watched Dante die. The lurching of the airplane as they flew over Texas and on and on. Dana peppered him with questions, random and insightful. She was as intrigued by the adventure as Keith, and at times incredulous. When the bottle was empty, Keith stretched out on the sofa and fell into a deep sleep. Chapter 34. With Judge Henry's approval, the press conference was held in the main courtroom of the Chester County Courthouse on Main Street in downtown Sloan. Robbie had planned to hold it in his office, but when it became apparent that a mob would attend, he changed his mind. He wanted to make sure every possible reporter could be accommodated, but he didn't want a bunch of curious strangers poking around his train station. At 9:15 a.m., Robbie stepped to the podium in front of Judge Henry's bench and surveyed the throng. Cameras clicked and tape recorders were turned on to catch every word. He wore a dark 3-piece suit, his finest, and though exhausted, he was also wired. He wasted little time getting to the point.
"Good morning and thanks for coming," he said. The skeletal remains of Nicole Yarber were found yesterday morning in a remote section of Newton County, Missouri, just south of the city of Joplin. I was there, along with members of my staff, accompanying a man named Travis Boyette. Boyette led us to the site where he buried Nicole almost 9 years ago, 2 days after he abducted her here in Sloan. Using dental records, the crime lab in Joplin made a positive identification last night. The crime lab is working around the clock to examine her remains, and their work should be completed in a couple of days. He paused, took a sip of water, and scanned the crowd. Not a sound. I'm in no hurry, folks. I plan to go into considerable detail. Then I will answer all the questions you have. He nodded at Carlos, who was seated nearby with his laptop. On a large screen next to the podium, a photo of the gravesite appeared. Robbie began a methodical description of what they had found, illustrated by one photo after another. Pursuant to an agreement with the authorities in Missouri, he did not show the skeletal remains. The site was being treated as a crime scene. He did use the photos of Nicole's driver's license, credit card, and the belt Boyette used to strangle her. He talked about Boyette and gave a brief explanation of his disappearance. There was not yet a warrant for his arrest, so Boyette wasn't a wanted man. It was obvious that Robbie was relishing the moment. His performance was being broadcast live. His audience was captive, spellbound, and hungry for every detail. He could not be interrupted or challenged on any point. It was his press conference, and he was finally getting the last word. The moment was a lawyer's dream. There would be several points during the morning when Robbie belabored a topic, beginning with his heartfelt ramblings about Dante Drum. The audience, though, refused to be bored. He eventually got around to the crime, and this prompted a photo of Nicole, a very pretty, wholesome high school girl. Reva was watching. Phone calls had roused her. They had been up all night dealing with the fire at the feed store, a fire that was contained quickly and could have been much worse. It was certainly arson, a criminal act obviously carried out by black thugs seeking revenge against the family of Nicole Yarber. Wallace was still there, and Reva was alone. She cried when she saw her daughter's face, displayed by a man she loathed. She cried, and she seethed, and she ached. Reva was confused, tormented, thoroughly bewildered. The phone call last night from Judge Henry had spiked her blood pressure and sent her to the emergency room. Add the fire, and Reva was practically delirious. She had asked Judge Henry many questions. Nicole's grave? Skeletal remains? Her clothing and driver's license? Belt and credit card and all the way up in Missouri? She had not been dumped in the Red River near Rush Point. And worst of all, Drum was not the killer.
"It's true, Mrs. Pike," the judge said patiently. "It's all true. I'm sorry. I know that it is a shock."
A shock? Reva couldn't believe it and for hours refused to believe it. She'd slept little, ate nothing, and was still grasping for answers when she turned on the television and there was Flack, the peacock, live on CNN talking about her daughter. There were reporters outside in the driveway, but the house was locked, the curtains drawn, the blinds down, and one of Wallace's cousins was on the front porch with a 12-gauge shotgun. Reva was fed up with the media. She had no comment. Sean Fordyce was holed up in a motel south of town, fuming because she would not chat with him on camera. He had made a fool of her already. He reminded her of their agreement, of the signed contract, to which she responded, "Just sue me, Fordyce." Watching Robbie Flack, Reva for the first time allowed herself to think the unthinkable. Was Drum innocent? Had she spent the last 9 years hating the wrong person? Had she watched the wrong man die? And what about the funeral? Now that her baby had been found, she would need to be properly buried. But the church was gone.
Where would they have the funeral?
Reva wiped her face with a wet cloth and mumbled to herself.
Eventually, Robbie moved on to the confession. Here he picked up steam and was consumed by a controlled rage. It was very effective. The courtroom was silent. Carlos projected a photo of Detective Drew Kerber, and Robbie announced with great drama, "And here is the principal architect of the wrongful conviction." Drew Kerber was watching at the office. He had spent a horrible night at home. After leaving Judge Henry's, he had gone for a long drive and tried to imagine a happier ending to this nightmare. None appeared. Around midnight, he sat down with his wife at the kitchen table and bared his soul. The grave, the bones, the ID, the unmentionable idea that evidently they had nailed the wrong guy. Flack and his lawsuits and his threats of vigilante-style suing that would follow Kerber to his grave and the high probability of future unemployment, legal bills, and judgments. Kerber unloaded a mountain of grief upon his poor wife, but he did not tell the whole truth. Detective Kerber had never admitted, and he never would, that he had bullied Dante into confessing. As a chief detective with 16 years of experience, he earned $56,000 a year. He had three teenagers and a 9-year-old, a mortgage, 2 car payments, an IRA with around 10 grand, and a savings account with $800. If fired or retired, he might be entitled to a small pension, but he could not survive financially. And his days as a police officer would be over. "Drew Kerber is a rogue cop with a history of obtaining fake confessions," Robbie said loudly, and Kerber flinched. He was at his desk in a small locked office, all alone. He had instructed his wife to keep the TVs off in the house, as if they could somehow hide this story from his kids. He cursed Flack, then watched with horror as the slimeball explained to the world exactly how he, Kerber, had obtained the confession. Kerber's life was over. He might handle the ending by himself. Robbie moved on to the trial. He introduced more characters. Paul Coffey and Judge Vivian Grail. Photos, please. On the large screen, Carlos projected them side by side, as if still attached, and Robbie assailed them for their relationship. He mocked the brilliant decision to move the trial all the way to Paris, Texas, 49 miles from here. He drove home the point that he tried valiantly to keep the confession away from the jury, while Coffey fought just as hard to keep it in evidence. Judge Grail sided with the prosecution and her lover, the Honorable Paul Coffey. Paul Coffey was watching and seething. He was at the cabin by the lake, very much alone, watching the local station's exclusive live coverage of the Robbie Flack show, when he saw his face next to Vivian's. Flack was railing against the jury, as white as a Klan rally because Paul Coffey had systematically used his jury strikes to eliminate blacks, and, of course, his girlfriend up on the bench went along with it. Texas-style justice, Robbie lamented, over and over. He eventually moved away from the more tawdry aspects of the judge-prosecutor relationship and found his rhythm railing against the lack of evidence. Grail's face disappeared from the screen, and Coffey's was enlarged. No physical evidence, no dead body, only a trumped-up confession, a jailhouse snitch, a bloodhound, and a lying witness named Joey Gamble. Meanwhile, Travis Boyette was free, certainly not worried about getting caught, not by these clowns. Coffey had tried all night to conjure up a revised theory that would somehow link Dante Drummond, Travis Boyette. But fiction failed him. He felt lousy. His head ached from too much vodka, and his heart pounded as he tried to breathe under the crushing weight of a ruined career. He was finished, and that troubled him much more than the notion that he had helped kill an innocent young man. When he finished with the jailhouse snitch and the bloodhound, Robbie attacked Joey Gamble and his fraudulent testimony. With perfect timing, Carlos flashed up Gamble's affidavit, the one signed in Houston on Thursday, an hour before the execution. highlighted were Joey's statements admitting he lied at trial and admitting he was the first to suggest that Dante Drum was the killer. Joey Gamble was watching. He was at his mother's house in Sloan. His father was away. His mother needed him. He had told her the truth, and the truth had not been well received. Now he was shocked to see and hear his transgressions broadcast in such a startling way. He had assumed that when he came clean, he would be subjected to some level of embarrassment. But nothing like this. Joey Gamble lied repeatedly, Flack announced at full throttle, and Joey almost reached for the remote. And now he admits it. Joey's mother was upstairs in her bedroom, too upset to be around him. You helped kill that boy, she had said more than once. Not that Joey needed reminding. Robbie continued. Moving on from the incompetent investigation, the travesty of a trial, and the wrongful conviction, I would like to now discuss the Texas Court of Criminal Appeals. This court heard Dante's first appeal in February 2001. The body of Nicole Yarber was still missing. The court noted that there was no physical evidence in the trial. The court seemed slightly bothered by the lies of the jailhouse snitch. It nibbled at the edges of Dante's confession, but refused to criticize Judge Grail for allowing the jury to hear it. It commented on the use of the bloodhound testimony, saying perhaps it wasn't the best evidence to use in such a serious trial. But all in all, the court saw nothing wrong. The vote was 9 to affirm the conviction, 0 to overturn it. Chief Justice Milton Prudlow was watching. A frantic call from his law clerk had alerted him to the press conference, and he was with his wife in their small apartment in Austin, glued to CNN. If Texas had indeed executed an innocent man, he knew his court was in for an avalanche of scorching criticism. Mr. Flack seemed prepared to lead the attack. Last Thursday, Robbie was saying, at exactly 3:35 p.m., lawyers for Dante Drum filed a petition for relief, and we included a video that we had just taken of Travis Boyette confessing to the rape and murder. This was 2.5 hours before the execution. I assume the court considered this matter and was not impressed with the video or the affidavit, because an hour later the court denied relief and refused to stop the execution. Again, the vote was 9-0. On cue, Carlos flashed up the times and actions by the court. Robbie plowed ahead. The court closes for business each day at 5 p.m., even when an execution is pending. Our final filing was the last-minute affidavit and recantation by Joey Gamble. In Austin, attorneys for Dante called the court clerk, a Mr. Emerson Pugh, and informed him that they were on their way with the petition. He said the court would close at 5 o'clock, and he was right. When the attorneys arrived at the court at 5:07, the door was locked. The petition could not be filed. Prudlow's wife glared at him and said, I hope he's lying. Prudlow wanted to assure her that of course this loudmouth lawyer was lying. But he hesitated. Flack was too shrewd to make such damning statements in public without having the facts to back them up. Milton, tell me this guy's lying.
Well, honey, I'm not sure right now.
You're not sure? Why would the court close if the lawyers were trying to file something?
Well, we...
You're stuttering here, Milton, and that means you're struggling to tell me something that may or may not be entirely accurate. Did you see Boyette's video 2 hours before the execution?
Yes, it was past.
Oh, my God, Milton. Then why didn't you stop things for a few days? You're the Chief Justice, Milton. You can do anything you want. Executions are delayed all the time. Why not give it another 30 days or a year for that matter?
We thought it was bogus. The guy is a serial rapist with no credibility.
Well, right now he's got a hell of a lot more credibility than the Texas Court of Criminal Appeals. The murderer confesses, no one believes him, so he shows them exactly where he buried the body. Sounds pretty credible to me. Robbie paused and took a sip of water.
As for the governor, his office received a copy of the Boyette video at 3:11 Thursday afternoon. I don't know for sure whether the governor saw the video. We do know that at 4:30 he addressed a crowd of protesters and publicly denied a reprieve for Dante.
The governor was watching. He was standing in his office in the governor's mansion, dressed for a golf game that would not be played, with Wayne on one side and Barry on the other. When Robbie paused, he demanded,
"Is that true? Did we have the video at 3:11 p.m?"
Wayne lied first.
"Don't know. So much stuff was happening. They were filing junk by the truckload."
Barry told the second lie.
"This is the first I've heard of it."
"Did anyone see the video when it came in?" he asked, his irritation growing by the second.
"Don't know, boss, but we'll find out," Barry said.
The governor stared at the television, his mind spinning, trying to grasp the severity of what he was hearing.
Robbie was saying, "Even after denying clemency, the governor had the right to reconsider and stop the execution. He refused to do so."
The governor hissed the word asshole, then yelled,
"Get to the bottom of this and now!"
Carlos closed his laptop and the screen went blank. Robbie flipped through his legal pad to make sure he'd said enough. He lowered his voice and in a grave tone said,
"In closing, it is now obvious that we have finally done it. Those who study the death penalty and those of us who fight it have long feared the day when this would happen, when we would wake up to the horrible fact that we have executed an innocent man and that it can be proven by clear and convincing evidence. Innocent men have been executed before, but the proof was not clear. With Dante, there is no doubt."
A pause. The courtroom was still and silent.
"What you will see in the days to come will be a pathetic game of finger-pointing, lying, and dodging blame. I've just given you the names and some of the faces of those responsible. Go after them. Listen to their lies. This did not have to happen. This was not an unavoidable mistake. This was a willful disregard for the rights of Dante Drum. May he rest in peace. Thank you."
Before the onslaught of questions, Robbie stepped to the bar and took the hand of Roberta Drum. She rose and walked stiffly to the podium, Robbie by her side. She pulled the microphone down a bit closer and said,
"My name is Roberta Drum. Dante was my son. I have little to say at this moment. My family is grieving. We are in shock. But I beg of you, I plead with the people of this town to stop the violence. Stop the fires and the rock throwing, the fighting, the threats. Please stop it. It does no good. Yes, we are angry. Yes, we are wounded. But the violence serves no purpose. I call on my people to lay down your arms, to respect everyone, and to get off the streets. The violence does nothing but harm the honor of my son."
Robbie led her back to her seat, then smiled at the crowd and said,
"Now, does anyone have a question?"
Chapter 35. Matthew Burns joined the Schroeder family for a late breakfast of pancakes and sausage. The boys ate quickly and returned to their video games. Dana made more coffee and began clearing the table. They discussed the press conference, Robbie's brilliant presentation of the case, and Roberta's poignant remarks. Matthew was curious about Sloan, the fires and violence, but Keith had seen little of it. He had felt the tension, smelled the smoke, heard the police helicopter hovering overhead, but he had not seen much of the town. With fresh coffee, the three sat at the table and talked about Keith's improbable journey and the whereabouts of Travis Boyette. Keith, though, was growing weary of the details. He had other issues, and Matthew was prepared for the conversation. "So, counselor, how much trouble could I be in?" Keith asked. "The law's not real clear. There's no specific prohibition against aiding a convicted felon in his efforts to violate the terms of his parole, but it's still against the law. The applicable code section deals with obstruction of justice, which is a huge net for a lot of behavior that would otherwise be difficult to classify. By driving Boyette out of this jurisdiction, and with the knowledge that it was a violation of his parole, you violated the law." "How serious?" Matthew shrugged, grimaced, stirred his coffee with a spoon. "It's a felony, but not a serious one. And it's not the type of violation that we get excited about." "We?" Dana asked. "As in prosecutors. The district attorney would have jurisdiction, a different office. I'm with the city." "A felony?" Keith asked. "Probably. It appears that your road trip to Texas has gone unnoticed here in Topeka. You managed to avoid the cameras, and I have yet to see your name in print." "But you know about it, Matthew," Dana said. "I do, and I suppose that technically I'm expected to inform the police to turn you in, but it doesn't work that way. We can process only so much crime. We're forced to pick and choose. This is not a violation that any prosecutor would want to deal with." "But Boyette is a famous guy right now," Dana said. "It's just a matter of time before a reporter here picks up on the story. He jumped parole, took off to Texas, and we've seen his face for 3 days now."
"Yes, but who can link Keith to Boyette?"
"Several folks in Texas," Keith said.
"True, but I doubt if they care what happens here, and these folks are on our side, right?"
"I guess."
"So who can make the link? Did anyone see you with Boyette?"
"What about the guy at the halfway house?" Dana asked.
"It's possible," Keith said. "I went there several times looking for Boyette. I signed the register, and there was a guy at the desk, Rudy, I think, who knew my name. But he didn't see you drive away with Boyette late Wednesday night."
"No one saw us. It was after midnight." Matthew shrugged, satisfied. All three worked on their coffee for a moment, then Keith said,
"I can make the link, Matthew. I knew I was violating the law when I left with Boyette because you made things very clear. I made a choice. At the time, I knew I was doing the right thing. I have no regrets now, so long as Boyette is found before he hurts anyone else. But if he's not found, and if someone gets hurt, then I'll have a ton of regrets. I am not going to live with a possible criminal violation hanging over my head. We plan to deal with it now."
Dana and Keith were both looking at Matthew, who said,
"That's sort of what I figured."
"I'm not running from this," Keith said. "And we can't live with the threat of an officer knocking on the door. Let's get it over with." Matthew shook his head and said,
"Okay, but you'll need a lawyer."
"What about you?" Dana asked.
"A defense lawyer, as in criminal defense. Me? I'm now on the other side of the street, and frankly, I can help more over there."
"Could Keith possibly go to jail?" she asked.
"Get right to the point, don't you?" Keith said with a smile.
Dana was not smiling. Her eyes were moist. Matthew stretched his arms above his head, then leaned forward on his elbows.
"Here's my worst-case scenario. I'm not predicting this, it's just the worst case. If you admit your role in taking him to Texas, get ready for some coverage. Then, if Boyette rapes another woman, all hell breaks loose. I can see the DA playing hardball with you, but I cannot, under any scenario, see you going to jail. You may have to plead guilty, get probation, pay a small fine, but I doubt it."
"I'd stand in court in front of a judge and plead guilty?"
"That's what usually happens."
Keith took Dana's hand on the table. There was a long moment of reflection. Then she said,
"What would you do, Matthew?"
"Hire a lawyer and pray Boyette is either dead or too ill to attack someone." At noon, the 41 white members of the Sloan High School football team met in the parking lot of a small elementary school on the edge of town. There, They quickly boarded a chartered bus and left town. Their equipment was in a rental van behind the bus. An hour later, they arrived at Mount Pleasant, population 15,000. From there, the bus followed a police car to the high school football field. The players dressed quickly and hustled to the field for their pregame routines. It was odd, warming up with no lights and no fans. Security was tight. Police cars blocked every possible route to the field. The Lobos of Longview High took the field minutes later. There were no cheerleaders, no band, national anthem, pregame prayer, or public address announcer. As the coin was tossed, the Sloan coach looked across the field at the Lobos and wondered how bad the slaughter might be. They had 80 players on a roster that was at least 70% black. Sloan had not beaten Longview since the days of Dante Drum, and the Warriors had no chance today. What was happening in Sloan was being felt throughout East Texas, if not far beyond. Sloan won the toss and elected to receive. It really didn't matter, but the Sloan coach wanted to avoid a long kickoff return and a quick 7 points. His receiving team took the field, and the Lobos lined up to kick. 10 black kids and a white kicker. At the whistle, the player closest to the ball suddenly stepped forward and grabbed it. It was a move that had never been seen before, and for a second everyone was startled. The 10 black members of the kickoff team then yanked off their helmets and laid them on the turf. The referees blew their whistles, the coaches yelled, and for a few seconds there was total confusion. On cue, the other black Longview players walked onto the field, dropping their helmets and jerseys as they went. The Sloan players on the field backed away in disbelief. The game was over before it began. The black players formed a tight circle and sat together at midfield, the modern-day version of a sit-in. The officials, 4 white and 2 black, huddled briefly and kept their cool. None of the 6 volunteered to attempt to get the football. The Longview coach walked to midfield and said, "What the hell is going on here?" "Game's over, coach," said number 71, a 330-pound tackle and co-captain. "We ain't playing," said number 2, the other co-captain. "Why not?" "It's a protest," said number 71. "We're solid with our brothers in Sloan." The coach kicked the turf and weighed his options. It was clear that this situation was not about to change, not anytime soon. "Well, just so you understand what you're doing here, this means we'll have to forfeit, which knocks us out of the playoffs, and you'll probably find some kind of probation for us. That what you guys want?" All 60 or so said, "Yes," in unison. The coach threw up his hands, walked off the field, and sat on the bench. The Sloan coach called his players off the field. From both sidelines, the white players stared at the black players. Green Lobo jerseys and helmets littered the field. The officials retreated to an end zone and watched. Their day was done. Minutes passed as reality set in. Then, from the Longview sideline, number 35, a white backup fullback, stepped onto the field, removed his helmet and jersey, and took a seat on the 40-yard line, near his black teammates. One by one, the other players followed, until only the coaches were left on the sideline. The Sloan coach wasn't sure what to do. He was thinking that perhaps he had just been handed a victory, snatched by a miracle from certain defeat. He was about to tell his players to leave the field when number 88, Denny Weeks, the starting tight end and the son of a Sloan police officer, stepped onto the field, dropped his helmet, and pulled off his jersey. He sat on the field with the Longview players, one of whom reached over and shook his hand. One by one, the Warriors followed, until all 41 had left the sideline. At 3 o'clock p.m., the governor's office issued a statement for the press, drafted by Barry Ringfield and rewritten by Wayne Walcott and the governor himself. Its final version read, "Governor Gil Newton is deeply concerned about recent events in the matter of Dante Drum. The allegations that this office received a videotape of a confession by the alleged killer just before the execution are simply false. The governor first saw the video yesterday, Friday, approximately 16 hours after the execution. The governor will be available on Monday for additional comments. The train station finally closed Saturday afternoon. Aaron Ray placed two armed guards on the landing with orders to threaten anyone who came near. The Flack firm gathered at Robbie's house for an impromptu party. Everyone was there, along with spouses. Dee Dee hired a caterer who specialized in barbecue, and the rich smell of ribs on the grill wafted over the patio. Fred Pryor manned the bar and the drinks flowed. Everyone lounged in the pool house and tried to relax. The Longhorns were playing football, and the television drew some interest. Robbie tried to prohibit any discussion of the drum case, but the conversation drifted there anyway. They couldn't help themselves. They were exhausted, drained, and defeated, but managed to unwind. The booze helped a lot. The Longview game was making the rounds, and they tipped a glass in honor of the sit-in. Fred Pryor, while bartending, monitored the police chatter on his radio. The streets of Sloan were remarkably calm, which they attributed to Roberta Drum's emotional plea. They had also heard that Roberta, Marvin, Cedric, and Andrea had gone to Washington Park and pleaded with the people to go home, to stop the violence. Though Robbie had ordered all cell phones turned off, the call came through anyway. Carlos received it and relayed the news to a hushed audience. The authorities in Joplin had expedited their examination and had some interesting news. On Nicole's underwear, they had found a significant semen sample. DNA testing matched it to Travis Boyette. His DNA sample was in the Missouri data bank due to a previous conviction there. There was reason to celebrate, and reason to weep. With emotions torn both ways, they decided to have another drink. Chapter 36. Sunday. What had been probable on Thursday, even likelier on Friday, and virtually certain on Saturday, became the numbing truth during the night, so that on Sunday morning the country awoke to the sensational reality that an innocent man had been executed. Led by the New York Times and the Washington Post, the big dailies railed and ranted and all reached the same conclusion. It's time to stop the killing. The story was page one in both papers, and in dozens of others from Boston to San Francisco. Lengthy articles gave the history of the case, and the characters were well advertised, with Robbie Flack getting as much attention as Dante. Screeching editorials called for a moratorium on executions. There were countless guest columns by legal experts, defense lawyers, death penalty abolitionists, professors, activists, ministers, even a couple of men on death row. And the same conclusion was reached. Now that we have unassailable evidence of a wrongful execution, the only fair and sensible course is to stop them forever. Or, if that can't be done, at least stop them until the death penalty system can be studied and overhauled. In Texas, the Houston Chronicle, a paper that had gradually grown weary of the death penalty but had stopped short of calling for its abolition, covered its front page with an unrestrained summary of the case. It was a condensed version of Robbie's press conference, with large photographs of Dante, Nicole, and Robbie on page one, and a dozen more on page five. The stories, all six of them, hit hard at the mistakes and peeled skin off Drew Kerber, Paul Coffey, and Judge Vivian Grail. The identities of the villains were clear. Blame was inescapable. One reporter was on the trail of the Texas Court of Criminal Appeals, and it was obvious that there would be no place for the court to hide. Chief Justice Milton Prudlow was unavailable for comment, as were the other eight justices. The clerk of the court, Mr. Emerson Pugh, refused comment. However, Cicely Avis, the defender group lawyer who tried to enter Pugh's office at 5:07 Thursday afternoon, had plenty to say. The details were emerging, with more stories sure to come. Another Chronicle reporter was stalking the governor and his staff, all evidently in full retreat. Reactions varied around the state. newspapers known to be generally moderate in their politics, those in Austin and San Antonio, called for outright abolition of the death penalty. The Dallas paper was on record calling for a moratorium. Newspapers that were firmly on the right went light on the editorials, but could not resist full-blown coverage of the events in Sloan. On television, the Sunday morning talk shows all found room for the story, though the presidential campaign was still the main topic. On cable, Dante Drum had been the lead story since Robbie's press conference 24 hours earlier, and it showed no signs of slipping to number two. At least one of the subplots had been deemed important enough to have its own title. The Hunt for Travis Boyette could be seen every 30 minutes. On the internet, the story was all the rage, showing five times more hits than anything else. Anti-death penalty bloggers railed with uncontrolled fury. As tragic as it was, the story was a huge gift for those on the left. On the right, things were predictably quiet. Those who supported the death penalty were not likely to change, not overnight anyway. But there seemed to be a general feeling that it was a good time to say nothing. The hard right cable shows and AM radio commentators simply ignored the story. In Sloan, Sunday was still a day of worship. At the Bethel African Methodist Church, a crowd much larger than normal gathered for the 8 a.m. call to worship, to be followed by Sunday school, a men's prayer breakfast, choir practice, Bible lessons, coffee and donuts, and eventually the worship hour, which would go on far longer than 60 minutes. Some were there in hopes of seeing one of the drums, preferably Roberta, and maybe offering a quiet word of condolence. But the drum family needed rest and stayed at home. Some were there because they needed to talk, to hear the gossip, to lend support or to receive it. The sanctuary was overflowing when the Reverend Johnny Canty stepped to the pulpit and warmly welcomed the crowd. It didn't take long to get to the issue of Dante Drum. It would have been easy to stir up his people, to throw gas on the fire, to hit all the open targets. But Reverend Canty was not inclined to do so. He talked about Roberta and her grace under pressure.